theland.ning.com. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, 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 beyond. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, and welcome to Ever Beyond on Ever Beyond Radio, as et cetera, et cetera. You just heard all that. We're definitely, we're connected with all of those, plus more on the telepathic channels as well. And apparently we're big on Aldebaran now. Since I've started talking about the Glock, they're quite interested in that sort of thing. So, big shout out going to our friends in Aldebaran. So, tonight we're going to be talking about some ancient times and what was going on in places where they didn't write books about what was going on then. So much, well, they did write books about what was going on, but it was mostly written from the victor's point of view. So, today we're going to be speaking with John Tudor, who's speaking from somewhere deep in Middle England, in Middle Earth, in the 23rd century before. We're here in the 21st century. Hang on, just to make sure that we are here in this space time. We were chatting the other day. I said something about the Pope, and you know, as I usually do, and we started talking about the British early churches, which I've, you know, is a particular interest of mine, having visited Glastonbury Abbey and you know, meditated there and felt the energy of the original chapels and all that stuff. So I'd like to welcome you on, John. Good afternoon. Hi. How are you?
I'm absolutely fine. How's yourself?
I'm good. I'm good today. We've had a lovely weekend. How's the weather? And where are you down there exactly?
At the moment, we're in Norwich, which is one half of our base, and our other half, where I often talk from, is in southern Spain on the Costa del Sol. But at the moment, we're on our Norwich base, where it's lovely. Weather's very nice.
Lovely. Nice wee May afternoon and evening. So, so welcome to Ever Beyond, John. And, like I said, we were chatting the other week, and there was this kind of back and forth going on. And I thought, oh, you know some stuff that not a lot of people know about. So,
confession, you see, because I'm afraid I haven't got a book to sell. Have you got the book to sell?
No. I might have soon.
I might have soon. So yeah. This might be a first, an alternative transmission with nobody with a book to sell.
Yeah, well, no, I do have guests who don't have books to sell. Just, you know, I drag people on just because they're interesting and because they've got an unusual viewpoint. You know, you don't have a book to sell, but you do have a website. And you do have a radio station, and you do have stuff going on. So, you know, you're a nexus of stuff. So we had a little roundtable early on from Open Your Mind Ireland, and we had a couple of people from a group project called the United We Strike effort, and we had a little roundtable because we were like four people who were chat show hosts. And so we had a discussion about what we knew about what was going on through the people that we've been speaking to in our radio shows. And that was quite an interesting little exchange there. So as we were talking, we were talking about what happened in Britain at the time of Jesus and before. So I'm not gonna step in your way, John, because what I'd like you'll be able to put the picture right across So just take a deep breath and just start at the beginning and work on through until 1 a.m. Be my guest.
Well, you've got a track somewhere handy, haven't you?
Music. Yeah, what would you like, actually?
No, that one I sent over, did you get it?
Oh, yeah. Where is it? Oh, no. It was several hours ago, so it should have arrived by now. Where is it? There we go. Do you want me to play it right now?
Yeah, the reason is that this is one of the pivotal things that started me off on the alternative track. This is a song very well known to almost everybody in the UK, and it's sung at rugby matches, and it's got a very peculiar, it's very short, and it's got a very peculiar first verse. So, I think we should play it, because I started out about age 10 wondering, what the heck did this mean? So I think this has set the scene quite well.
Okay, well, it's taken my computer that whole time to do that, because for some reason it's decided to go slow right down,
Well, if you haven't got it, I've got it,
I'm just about on it right now, there we go, today, and, here we go, and away we go.
We go, little piece of pure Britain there for you.
this is like a spiritual national anthem for Britain, isn't it?
It actually
creates more shivers and more kind of gritty, true British Isles energy than go da da da, you know, because It is about the land itself and not the rulers and the ruling classes.
Well, the other one, of course, being Rule Britannia, but we're not allowed to sing the ones about doing the Scots in anymore.
Mustn't do the Scots in anymore. Mustn't bash the Scots.
Might be able to next time when they get independence, of course. Anyway, back to the plot.
This
is a poem, originally a poem, and the music was added some nearly 20 years later. It was written by William Blake in 1804. And it was first published, which is quite a while ago. Now, what's interesting is, if you look this up on Wikipedia, it says there is no evidence whatsoever or a tradition of Jesus ever having been in England or Britain. None of those traditions arrived until the early 20th century. Well, this was a century before that, so you can rip the Wikipedia page up on that for a start. Now, I'm just going to repeat the first verse, which is the whole point. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? So, where does that come from? That's where I started when I was about 10, scratching my head. And then my grandmother told me about the Glastonbury Thorn. And I understand you know lots about the Glastonbury Thorn, don't you, Jay?
I have a little story about the Glastonbury Thorn, I do.
You do? Right. Well, there's a plant, a tree, which Jay will tell you a little bit more about, because I'm sure I haven't actually seen the thing. But it's supposed to come from the Holy Land, and the tradition is that Joseph of Arimathea stuck his staff in there and it sprouted, and lo and behold, we have a Middle Eastern tree sat in the middle of England. Is that about the size of it, Jay?
Can't get a staff these days. Yeah, the story is that in days gone by, the county of what is known now as Somerset was used to be known as the place of the Somersetting people. That means they settled in the summer, and in the winter it beat down and it flooded all the time. And so basically, if you needed to get to Glastonbury, which was known as Avalon, it was an island in the winter, and it was surrounded by mist because there were springs there. So it was actually slightly warmer. It was, you know, it had this little sort of Eden-like atmosphere because it had the sort of connecting with the poles of the planet. And it does have a kind of warmer, home-like feel to it. And I lived in Glastonbury for a year. So much happened. So many things happened. It was like a kind of whirlwind of evolution. Because it does, it's like a vortex of evolution. If you want to go kind of fast track, just live in Glastonbury for a year. There were many stories there of the of the beginning of the abbey, which was made in just after the crucifixion. Mary came, and we got to go back to what the stick was about. All right, so here's the thing. I was talking about the thorn.
That's where it all starts.
Yeah, so because it's like that, there's this place where the harbour was. Nowadays it's a B&Q, right? But the harbour was a place that is now a hill, the hill is called Weary All Hill, or Wirial Hill, but it's Weary All the hill of all the weary, because this is the place, because Glastonbury is uphill, right? It's a really steep little kind of rock in the middle of nowhere.
Looks just like a witch's hat for people who don't know what it looks like.
Yeah. And you walk, you schlep yourself up the hill, and there at the top is what was purported to be the staff, which was I can't remember exactly. It's a, it's the thorn that you find in Israel, right? It is the actual same kind of thorn that you find in Israel.
We do have the same species of thorn in England, but this is a variant, as you quite rightly say, that's only found in like Syria and the Holy Land. Yeah,
that's right. Now, a few years ago. Now, at this point, right, up to about 2010 or so, this was a little bush. You know, it was about like 8 feet high, you know, max. And, you know, it was thick about, you know, the stem, the trunk was about like 8 to 9 inches thick. You know, it's a little thorn bush, but it was a thorn bush. It was, you know, gnarly and really old and, anyway, so a few years ago, another part of the story, a piece of this thorn is given to the Queen every year. What do you know about that, John?
Oh, I did know that, and they keep cuttings going, and I believe there's also some in a priory garden in Glastonbury, I think.
Yeah, but
the ones that were taken from the Queen.
Yeah, well, from this particular bush. I mean, they've got cuttings, but this one has the symbolic stuff. It's the symbolic bush, and it's something to do with the actual thing, right? So, a few years ago, this bush was vandalized. Somebody cut all the branches off, and it was just left as, you know, it's like a 6 foot stem. And everybody was really up in arms about it. Oh, da, 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 da. Anyway, so a few years ago, I had the opportunity to drive a van down from Scotland, down to the south of England. And I thought, I'll take in some sights as I come back. And so I did a big loop around the south of England, and I chanced on Glastonbury to see a few old friends. And while I was waiting for one friend, I went up to Wirral Hill, parked the van at the top, of course, didn't move over, and I went to sit by the tree. And I sat by the tree and meditated by the tree, and, you know, just said, you know, hello, and the tree said, oh, hello. And, it didn't say hello, but it was like a greeting. It felt warm. And So I said, you know, aren't you a bit sort of thing? And it had this really weird, nonchalant kind of attitude. It's like, that's all right, I've been a stick before. I've grown back. I'm cool. And actually there was a... And then he transmitted this thing, which was like an idea that the Queen was somehow disempowered by this apparent vandalism. That this would mark the end of her power. And... That it was something to do with, you know, everything was all in order, and it's okay. You don't have to worry about me. I'll be fine. And that was the message I got from the tree.
Well, yeah. So now we know.
So it was just another piece of the puzzle. So anyway, back to Glastonbury Abbey, which is down the road, is Glastonbury Abbey, and that's where, after the crucifixion, Mary and some of the apostles came and built 13 huts in what was known as the New Jerusalem formation. And that's like a sacred geometric thing, but you should probably peg it out and mark it out with stakes and stuff. But it's 12 huts around a central 13th. And that's been clairvoyantly viewed by people throughout the last couple of hundred years when people have been doing this clairvoyant viewing. There's some bloke with his surname, his funny surname, who did some of this viewing. Do you know about that guy?
No.
Anyway, so you're talking more about the British Gnostic history. So I'll stop interrupting.
So it's not so much Gnostic, really. It's ancient. We've started here, and we've kind of established in a folksy sort of way that Joseph of Arimathea was there. There's a long tradition of it, and there's historical scribblings down the histories of this. So I thought most people don't know particularly much about Joseph of Arimathea. Now, he's pivotal to this. So I wondered if I can just witter about that for a moment or two.
Witter to your heart's content, my friend. You have 2 hours. Well, you've got less than 2 hours because I've taken up 20 minutes on it. Anyway, go on.
That was jolly good. right. Well, the medieval genealogists decided that Joseph was a relative of Jesus, specifically Mary's uncle, or Joseph's uncle, depending on who you believe. But at any rate, he does appear to be related. It also appears that Arimathea was not a place, but a title, a job title, one of rank, rather than a place. They can't seem to track the place, and current thinking is it was a title. So, what did he do? Well, they say he was a wealthy tin merchant. Now, for about a good 1,000 years before all this happened, the Phoenicians had basically a bus service that ran every couple of weeks, from what we can see, out of Tyre and Sidon, and it ran into Cornwall and up the Bristol Channel, selling goods from the Far East, wine and figs and so forth, and taking back tin. And one of the guys, if not the guy, who was making a fortune out of this stuff later on, because that had gone on for donkeys and donkeys, and they needed tin to make bronze and so on. And so there was a roaring trade that went on for ages, and in the middle of a creek in Cardiff in Wales, which is barely a spit as a crow flies from Glastonbury, really. It's not far at all, 20 or 30 miles. They found a Phoenician ship, which was dated by wood to about 1000 BC. The professor on the project said that's impossible because there weren't any Phoenicians until 800 BC, and he overrode the dendrochronology and rewrote it as 800. But nevertheless, there was like a bus service that ran between Tyre and Sidon and the British Isles. So not only did iron and tin come both ways, but people did. And the Druids had two wings to the Druids. Most people think of Druids as just being some guys with sickles and white sheets and doing wonderful things and chanting and looking at the sunrise. But there was another wing of the Druids which were involved with what they considered to be science, astrology, astronomy, bits of chemistry, metal smelting, that kind of thing. And this lot, if you translate it from the Welsh, translates as the Sons of Sidon, which is the other end of the bus. Yeah? So people, it's said from what I've been reading here and there, if you were a rich guy, I don't know, if you're like a Rockefeller or something, you might send your kid off to finishing school away from the Far East, the Middle East, and get them an education in the far land, learn some stuff, and come back.
Well, like you have Saudis sending their children to Oxford and Cambridge.
Exactly the same. And also people on the make. So, I mean, at the moment, when we're in Spain, we get an awful lot of, how can I describe them, suddenly rich Russians sending them to international finishing schools in Spain. There's a roaring trade in that. So, as a few reasons why you might do it, and also if you're a ruler or something, you might send your son away for, you know, learn a bit about the world and other peoples and get some ideas and all sorts. And so these people would go to Bodmin Moor, where they had a kind of university, and learn astronomy, astrology, and there's a great big observatory there, and there's all sorts of stories about people being taught there and going back to the Far East with the knowledge. So we have a bus service going. So Joseph of Arimathea was a big cheese in the tin trade. So he was really wealthy, and he had a load of boats, or at least he commissioned a load of boats going backwards and forwards all the time. And it is said that Jesus was taken there as a young man, probably around the age of 13, which is where he disappears from the Bible. And while he was there, some of the stories and some of the poems say that he did very well. And the kings under the Druid system were not handed down generation to generation. They're elected. In effect, they're presidents. And it is said that not only did he become a president, if you like, of his little area, not a kingdom as we would know it, it's probably the size of a county, he was so well thought of that he was given the name Pendragon. Now, Pendragon means King of Kings, or Ozymandias in Greek. Now, that doesn't particularly mean very much in the world today as we would know it, because if your bit of England has got 30 kings who are normally fighting with each other and you need somebody to talk to the Romans, then they'd all get together and elect a Pendragon, and the Pendragon would go down and do the deal for all of them, and that would be a done deal. So there are stories and traditions of him being that. And when he was taken, when he then went back as a young man, probably about 28, 29, to the Holy Land, now educated, I mean, there's good reasons which I can talk for hours about, which I'm not going to now because it's off topic, as to why he became into that rich family and royal lines and things. But now you have a King of Kings coming in, giving the Romans a load of lip, giving them a load of grief, basically. And they got him and put a crown of thorns on him as if he was a king, which some believe he indeed was. So you start joining all this lot together, and the whole thing starts looking rather more interesting. Now, Joseph of Arimathea was very, very famous guy in his community. He was a member of the Sanhedrin, which means the Supreme Council of ancient Israel, which would make him a senator or something like that in the House of Lords if it was in England. So he was pretty well thought of, and he was able to go to Pilate and ask for the body of Jesus. Well, not everybody can just go up to Pilate, let alone ask him a favour. So he was obviously pretty well thought of. Now, then Jesus dies or disappears. At which point I find two trails. One comes back to the UK for a very short time, and the other one doesn't. And he goes and eastwards into India, meets up with his brother Thomas, some say twin brother Thomas, which is rather eyebrow raising, Thomas Didymus meaning a twin, and he was buried in Kashmir, in the Himalayas, aged about 84, next to his brother. So we have a situation now where Joseph then goes back to the UK and helps set up, with or without Mary, take your story, or maybe they just came on different boats. I don't know, but there are stories of the pair of them having turned up and establishing a Christian church. And the Romans sacked Palestine in AD 70, so it had to be well before that we now have a church in England. And to this day there is a small movement called the English Catholic Church who try to carry that on, as opposed to the Roman Catholic Church. And it exists right now. Were you aware of that? These tales I'm talking about, Jay?
Okay, now, as far as the English Catholic Church, the first time it was news to me was when you put it in that chat. And that's why I thought I got to get this guy on, because there is a spiritual movement that's happening in the world that may be connected with this original Christian in a more it's like it's closer to orthodoxy, isn't it?
Well, what's orthodoxy?
Well, you know, like the Greek Orthodox or the Russian Orthodox, which is the Catholic Church.
In those days there were three big factions. I mean, you had the Gnostics, who were weird in that they didn't actually believe Jesus had a body, and it was made of pure spirit. And when he died, his body didn't die, his spirit fled, which was rather interesting to the others, who didn't think that was right. I mean, then you've got the Arius guys, who thought there was God the Father, and until Jesus came along, there wasn't a God the Son, and there wasn't a God the Holy Spirit, there was only God. And the guys trying to push for the Trinity weren't happy about that, so, you know, and there's got to be about another 16 sects as well, and nobody was happy with anybody, were they, at that time?
You know, very much like, I think, the Holy Grail film with the Monty Python. There was very much, I'm sure that they really kind of tapped into some reality there, you know, of how stupid people can be.
Mm. Well, this is one of the problems that later on came to face, God, what's his name? It's gone out of my head. Constantine, a little later. So you're right. I mean, if you went there now and you took a Greek Orthodox guy there and you took a Roman Catholic priest there, I think it would be far more like the Greek Orthodox than the Roman Catholic Church, yes.
So, let's go, hang on, I've got a special button that takes us way back.
Bloody hell.
Meanwhile, 2,000 years ago.
Gosh.
I know. Was it a bit of a journey for you?
It was good for me. Yeah. Did you feel the Earth move?
Well, I moved on, across the face of time and space, and I dragged you with me, and all the rest of the audience. So we're now in early Christian Britain. Now, you were also saying that the early Gnostics talked about that the idea of Christ is kind of like the spirit of Christ is an important factor, that people kind of focused it down into one person, but that there are other groups who are saying no, the spirit is more, this is more important, there's a spirit, that we're all Christ.
The Gnostics weren't really one cohesive group. I mean, there was lots of flavours of them. I mean, they were scrapping amongst themselves, from what I can gather. But I mean, it's where are we? Here's a quote. it's a religion, this is talking about Gnosticism, a religion that differentiates the evil god of the world, who is identified as the god of the Old Testament, from a higher, more abstract god revealed by Jesus Christ, a religion that regards the world as the creation of a series of evil archons stroke powers who wish to keep the human soul trapped in an evil body. And the religion preaches a hidden wisdom or knowledge that only a set group who were told as necessary get told the secrets of salvation to escape from this trap of the world. I mean, yeah, they are the people that know, not the knights that say nay.
And here's the thing, right? They had a special diet, and I bet it involved avoiding yeast, as in beer and bread. Is that true?
I hadn't heard that, but it wouldn't surprise me. They were a pretty strict lot.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Beer and bread, in my humble, is the control mechanism of the ancient gods who are still worshipped today.
Yeah.
In terms of the dark gods, and it's the control mechanism, because it takes over our nervous system in terms of cravings and addictions, and we find ourselves like doing things that we know we shouldn't do, but why are we doing it? Because this thing has a deeper craving.
So you're blaming it all on the pint and the pie, then?
I'm blaming it on the loaf of bread. Actually, it's beer and pizza, as I was saying in the last
beer
show.
And pizza,
beer and pizza, or what it used to be, wine and bread. You know, and there it is in the communion. Yeah, you're taking in an organism through the yeast that is made into the wine and the bread.
And what is interesting is the Gnostics were, in the very early days, were pretty bright. They a lot of the big cheeses in the Gnostic movement, they were Greeks. They were very educated, more educated than the average Roman. I mean, the average Roman farmer didn't bother to learn to read. He just got himself a Greek slave, and you know, these were bright people. They were educated, they were read, and they were more bright than the other Christians, and they seemed to siphon off all the intellectuals, which is rather interesting, which left like the rednecks in the rest of the church, and these guys who were all bright and knew what they were talking about all went off to do their own thing. A bit odd.
Yeah, but, and they all went
to appear to be the case.
Yeah, they all went to monasteries and things like that, and shoved themselves away from the redneck rule.
Oh, they sat in caves, sat on the top of poles, all sorts of things. Yeah, they were doing their bit like the Anchorites later on. A lot of them were living very solitary existences, and others of them were living together, and you know, I mean, there's huge panoply of it. And of course they had their own gospels. I mean, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, we've all heard of those. I mean, the Gnostic gospels, jury's out on the Acts of Thomas, but I mean, anybody wants to follow these up. I mean, you've got the Gospel of Thomas, the Secret Book of James, Ballistides, Narcene Fragment, if I pronounce that right, Gospel of Mary, Dialogue of the Saviour, Gospel of the Saviour, Marcion, it goes on, there's another five of them. And all of those are basically the Gnostic Bible, or their Gospels used by different fragments. And these are available, and you can download them, and you can read them, and you'll find a rather different slant to Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, and different emphases on the same story, and little tidbits extra, things like that. Quite interesting.
So our story takes us to northwestern Europe, away from what was the Holy Land, the scene of the crucifixion and everything.
I'm saying that they're far more connected than most people realise.
Yeah.
There was a bus service, and the communication was better between between Palestine and at least Cornwall than Cornwall and anywhere else except France.
So it was a major route.
Yeah, it's to the other end of the bus. Yes. I mean, I call it the bus. I mean, but basically they were trading ships, but they ran on a schedule. You know, every 2 weeks your ship came in. You know, it was very, very regular.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there is international shipping that probably goes on exactly the same today. And it probably has the same, if you were probably looking at a trade route, you'd probably see that you're talking about exactly the same trade routes as the Phoenicians used to use.
Because, well, they were, originally the Phoenicians ran these. And then the Phoenicians kind of fade out of history because they got clobbered by the Romans. But Carthage, which was one of their colonies in North Africa, which is now Libya, basically became the tail that wagged the dog, because the Romans cut the head off the Phoenicians, but the puppies lived on. But there was a nice trade running there between Western Europe, I mean Britain and France and places, bringing in tin and copper and stuff that they needed. I can't believe that the Romans, being a pragmatic people, wouldn't have let it carry on and put the tax on it.
Exactly, yeah. They wouldn't have stopped it. They would just, they'd just extract as much cash or resources out of it. And that's probably what they probably bled it dry. Wherever their fuel was, the Romans would have restricted it.
Oh, they love it. They love it. I mean, in the African desert, they built this huge wall around the end of the empire after they gave the Carthaginians a pasting, and they put this great big wall around it. And it's getting on for 1,000 miles long, and it's got these gates every 5 miles, and it would appear that this wall said, "Sod off, beyond here is Rome. Behave yourself. Now, if you want to come in, pay your taxes, just like going through customs, pay your taxes, behave yourself, we'll say no more about it." So all they were doing was, as much trade went on as did before, the Romans just took their 10%, and life just carried on. And that's what they did, and if there was a real problem, they could always shut the gates, but it seems they hardly ever did. Yeah, so I think it's just like the European boundaries, but anyway, getting back to the plot, so you've got Western Europe, you've got a pipeline into the east, and you've got this church which is in Wales and then creeps out from there. And then the Romans arrive. The Romans didn't take over the whole of Britain. For our American and Canadian friends, they didn't manage to take over most of Wales. They had a few forts there, keep the locals down, but they could never really manage it. They never managed Scotland. They never managed Cornwall.
You'll never take me.
Well, they never managed Cornwall. Now, bearing in mind that the main reason for coming to Britain, allegedly, as it was sold into the, "Please can I take an army and a big bunch of money to the place where all the tin comes from?" Oh, yeah, all right. But they didn't take the place where the tin was. They didn't. They just let them carry on and let them pay a bit of tribute and let them carry on business as usual. Yeah. Well, I find that rather odd, because they didn't take it over and subdue it. They had a few goes, it didn't work, and in the end they just traded with them. And so it went on. So meanwhile, that little church of yours is expanding. And the Romans have turned up. And according to, if I can skip, can I skip forward a little bit in time?
Hang on. Meanwhile, later on.
Ah, gosh, that's handy. Right, meanwhile, a little later on, so this movement spreads. So you've got Wales and Glastonbury, and it starts spreading out. And it spreads out through what we call the Celtic kingdoms, except they didn't know what Celts were. They didn't even think they were Celts. They thought they were something else. And the Romans were pretty liberal when it comes to gods. If you want to subjugate somebody, you don't say your god is rubbish. You put up a nice little temple to your local god, and a whacking great big one next to it for Jupiter, and a whacking great next one next to that for Apollo, and you carry on. And they did that in Bath, didn't they, at Aquae Sulis, where you've got a temple to Minerva and the usual other three things, and everybody's happy. The locals can come and worship their old god, and you'd better stick your head round the temple of Jupiter and put a few coppers in the tin before you go home, but apart from that we'll say no more about it. And that's how the Romans carried on. So now we have this Christian thing spreading, and we have the Romans spreading, and they're spreading at the same time, and they're overlapping. But the Roman soldiers, they didn't really hold with Zeus and Apollo and all these guys. They had their own. And this guy was born on 25th of December of a virgin. Had three wise men come and visit him, bringing gifts, including gold. He was crucified. And he came back to life again, and he did miracles. And his name was Mithras. And the...
Wait a minute.
This is true, right? I mean, his birthday was right. We know Jesus' birthday wasn't right, because you don't have shepherds abiding in the fields in... at that time of the year, anywhere in the Middle East. So he had to be born sometime, well, I don't know, I've heard two dates, sort of end of April, middle of May, or September. But anyway, certainly not in the middle of winter. So to the Mithras people, this all fits jolly nicely. They believe in reincarnation. They believe that they go out, they do a good job, they have an honest life. They'll get reborn, and they'll go up the ladder, and they'll be brought back to life. And so if you're a soldier, getting killed's not that bad a deal, really, because you'll be back, or you'll be in a better place. And you've got the story of Christianity going pretty much the same tale. And so a lot of the Romans got quite interested in this. And there was a young lady who was a stable lass of low birth, probably in Wales, north of Cardiff by about 30 miles, just short of the Brecon Beacons. And she used to muck out horses. And she falls in love with some Roman guy. I don't know who. Might have been a soldier. Might have been a trader. I don't know. But some Roman.
The and Catherine Zeta-Jones Helen. Of our time.
Eh?
The Catherine Zeta-Jones of their time.
Oh, yes. A world-class... I can't say that word, can I? No.
No. Beauty. Let's just say she's beautiful and known for her beauty.
A lady on the make.
On the make.
On the make, on the way up. And she gets hold of this Roman guy. And she's only a stable lass, which to the Romans is the lowest of the low of the low. You know, basically you're a shit shoveler. And he gets married to her. And she's got a head on her. And very good looks. And knows how to use it. And she helps him work his way up, and he becomes the equivalent of a sergeant in York, and then a captain in York, and so on. He does so well, Centurion, and he gets posted to Rome. This guy's name was Constantine. Now, not many people know that Constantine spoke with a Yorkshire accent, but he probably did. So he turns up there. So what's the connection? Well, Helena was a Christian zealot, evangelist, nutcase, off the end stop. And she's really into this, and her son, she takes him to Rome and has affairs with not one, not two, but three emperors, one after the other.
Now, that's taking it seriously.
That is putting the hours in, isn't it?
Definitely getting the medal.
Talk about old age creeping on. You know, some of these guys were not in the first flush of youth. And she manages to, I mean, it's a bit like Dynasty or one of those soap operas. She manages to get her son to be joint emperor of the whole of the Roman Empire, because there was him and another guy, I've forgotten his name now, Leviticus. Anyway, there was another one, and they are Licinius, that's the guy.
Not litigious.
No. Or Ludicrous Sextus. No. he got rid of his last emperor and the other sort of vice one, because the Roman Empire was basically beginning to fall apart. It's the beginning of the end of the Western end of things. And he's got a religious nutcase of a mother who with certain talents, and all of a sudden he finds himself there. He gets rid of his other guy, and he now finds himself an emperor god, because in this time in Roman history, the Romans were gods. And you had your temple to Apollo, your temple to Diana, your temple to the big three, and you now had a nice little one on the side, which was for the cult of the emperor, and in there would be a statue of Nero, and they'd swap that out for Caligula and so on, right? So all of these have got Constantine in there. So, the queen, well, Eleanor, the mother, she had this vision. And the vision, I don't mean a religious vision, I mean an idea that what was needed to stop the whole place falling apart was there were too many religions and they're all fighting each other. And you needed one religion, one empire, and one emperor. And that was her motto. So that was what was going to happen. So she decided it was going to be Christianity that she'd brought over from England, or so the stories go. So she manages, I'm not quite sure how, with the help, she employs a naughty boy called Josephus, who's a scribe. And it would, some say he's, well, I'm not going to go into who else some people say he is, because I'll have Jeffy Daugherty on the phone screaming fire and brimstone at me any moment. But some people say he was somebody else. But anyway, they were sat there, and she said, right, we're going to have one religion. The trouble is, Christianity is split all over the place. So what we'll do is, and I'm making this bit up now, but it seems logical, what we're going to do is cobble it all up into one set of stories. Josephus can write it down. There you go. Right, we'll have one story, and that'll be it. But the soldiers will have insurrection. can't we have him born as a virgin? I mean, three wise men come in with gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and was crucified and resurrected, and because that'd be handy. Yeah, I think we can work that in. So now you've got the Romans on side. You've got the Roman soldiers on side because all they think is, well, that's just Mithras reincarnated. I'm quite happy with that. We won't have a problem with that at all. And in the catacombs, for 40 years in the last century, in the 2000s, in the early part, they used to take people down into the catacombs and show the pictures of these guys hanging on a cross and showing all these old churches that were showing pictures and telling all their pictures of Jesus hanging on the cross and doing miracles. And then somebody carbon dated the paint, 300 BC. This was Mithras. These were the soldiers' private little things. So we've now got the thing. So now you've got the Roman soldiers are basically going to be on side. They were the big enemy. Everybody else can stuff it, and we'll work something out. So then they decided, well, we're going to make this a state religion, which he never really succeeded in doing, despite what it says. So this cult, as I said, every major town had a temple to the emperor, and the head guy of the church of the emperor, the sect of the emperor, he had a title, and it was Pontifex Maximus, the Pope. So there was a pagan Pope before, and then all that was really needed was a makeover. All you have to do, okay, priest, here's your new uniform, yeah, get rid of that, put up a few fish, put up a few crosses, here's the new script, and that's how you could get it right across the Roman Empire, 5,000 miles across, in 4 years. So what do you make of that, Jay?
4 years? Is that 4 years. All it took?
Well, yeah,
to spread the meme.
Place.
Right.
It
so
was all in place.
Everything, so it's just what we call a relaunch.
Rebranding.
Yeah, yeah. New symbol. It was the ram, now here's the cross and the fish.
It would have been the head of the emperor, you know, and, mm-hmm. and his whatever his favourite animal was, and then you just the whole thing was in place. They even had a guy whose title was the Pope, and so it would be quite easy to do that. And all of a sudden, you've got a state religion. You haven't got to buy the buildings. You haven't got to hire the staff. You with me?
You can't get the staff anyway. So meanwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, we're at the top of the hour. Did you tell me what music you liked? Because you wanted the thing. What would you like to?
Well, I wanted that because I thought it was a suitable introduction.
Yes. I wonder where we could go from there. There's a thought.
Oh, put on your favourite. I don't mind.
There we go. Yeah, all right, I'm going to put on my favourite ever record. This is Elvis Costello. It's you probably like it as well. It's called Allison by Elvis Costello. Do you know?
That'll do fine. He's 60, but not dead.
Not that Elvis, anyway.
No.
Well, welcome back to Ever Beyond. We're here with John Tudor, and we're discussing the early church in Britain. And the development of the Roman Church, which became the Roman Catholic Church, out of what was essentially somebody who was already we're talking about Mithrasism. Mithrasism. Yeah. Now I remember when I was a kid, I lived in London, right, and below a bank, they were digging up a bank. in the city of London, and they discovered a temple to Mithras. And yeah. It still exists. They kind of rebuilt the thing sort of up in the street level, and you can still see it, and you could still visit it. I remember that, you know, that was something, a feature of my childhood. And so, yeah, so tell us, so we had Mithraism, which is essentially the same beliefs, but with a different branding. Now,
He had bulls.
He had bull.
If you find a if you find Mithras, you'll find bulls. Right, there were no bulls that I Mithraism. Sally's just saying, she's an archaeologist, so I better behave. She's a proper one with us.
Behave, mate. Behave. Or you. So, thank you very much. Mithraism. Yes.
Right. So, it's very much associated with bulls.
That's
so
interesting. That's a Taurian age, isn't it?
Well,
the age of Taurus, which is like 6,000 years ago.
Well, I don't think he was born then, but. Anyway, he had basically his logo was a bull. If you find a temple with a great big bull, you've either found Mithras or who was the Egyptian god?
Sorry,
who was the Egyptian god with the golden calf?
Oh, goddess Hathor.
Hathor.
Cow goddess.
The Egyptian one. You find them everywhere, and the other one is Mithras. So, yeah. Now, of course, the story of Mithras isn't new, because you can go back to Osiris, and born of a virgin, three wise men came and saw him. Died on a cross, resurrected. It's getting tedious now, isn't it? Bit of a theme. So, anyway, back to the plot. So we have a church set up in Rome with its roots in Wales. Now, don't you find that rather startling?
Well, so and we're not talking about Jonah either. We're talking about the country Wales. Yes. Which is a very small zone where they speak funny and they burn their houses. What else do they do? They sing. They
it's
all sing. They're all called
the
Jones.
Of Vermont.
Yeah.
And it's very mineral rich in the south. They've got plenty of coal and iron. And the Romans did like their iron. In the north, where there is a huge... one of the largest deposits of copper in Europe, at least it used to be. It's nearly all gone now. They're still digging it out to this day, and it's been dug out continuously. So the Romans did take that. And, what else can we say about Wales? It's very mountainous. It's very beautiful. They eat strange food, like... seaweed,
and they speak funny as well,
and they've got their own language, which is very strange, because you can't look the words up in a dictionary, because unlike German and English and French, where we change the ends of the words, and Latin, they change the beginning of the word. So unless you know how the word's spelt, you can't look it up.
The only word I know in Welsh, apart from Cymru, which is spelled Cymru, and I get this, I learned this when I was a kid, it's Clambaya Puthgungeth Gorgrifwind Robutlantisilio Gogogoch.
Which is the longest, what?
Railway station name in the world.
It is, for no good reason.
No
all
good
the locals
reason, yeah.
Call it Lampho PG.
Yeah.
Now, that's also rather interesting, and is kind to join to this story. Something
good segue,
there.
Eh? And how did he know?
Yeah,
must be the Holy Spirit.
So, it's only recently that they spelt Cymru with a C, isn't it?
Is it?
Did you know that?
No, I know nothing of spelling.
Right. Well, if you look up a map of Wales from early Victorian times, you'll find it spelt with a K and a KH and not a CY. and it's Cymru, C-H-U-M, Cymru. And different parts of Wales pronounced it and spelt it slightly differently. And they standardised it for the street signs, yeah? Because you're going to have street signs for this way to Wales and all that stuff. And it got changed from a hard K to a C in very recent times, within the last 100 years or so. Now, there is a place in the Middle East, part of Nimrod's outfit, where the Assyrians carried away, was it the Assyrians? Carried away some of the lost tribes. I think they carried away six of them. I think two had already gone. They took them and they shoved them in this big valley and set them to work. And the place they called it was Cymru. Sounds exactly the same. It's spelt almost exactly the same. And cut a long story short, that empire imploded and they all started marching westwards because they thought, well, this lot might get their act back together, because basically they ran out of money, they couldn't afford to pay the army, and the whole thing folded in on itself. So they up sticks and they set off and they went into Asia Minor and, so some say, built a city. And they stayed there for a while, the Cymru, and they had some scraps with the Greeks, because the Greeks called them Trojans, and it split into at least three groups. One group legs it and goes to Switzerland. Another group goes down into Italy, and they become the Etruscans, who nobody can speak Etruscan, and anybody will tell you that it can't be translated, except I know somebody who can translate it. And the rest of them went onto a Greek island, which is very wooded, and they built a load of boats, and it took them years. And I mean, like 10, 15 years. They built this huge lot of boats, and they set off for, quote, the green land beyond, well, they had another word for it, but the Pillars of Hercules. In other words, they went out into the Atlantic to the green, big green, fertile land. Now, if you talk to people in Wales and Cornwall, they will tell you that their ancestors came from a long way away from the Middle East. They came from Troy, and they are the Cymru. And believe that or not, there are plenty of Celts who will tell you that is the case. Now, people will also tell you that the Welsh had no written language and it was all handed down by oral tradition. But that's not true either. They had a written language for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. But when the Brits came in and took the place over, they stamped out any speaking of Welsh and nearly stamped it out. They were down to about 119,000 speakers at one point. No, 19,000 speakers at one point. And they're now up to a third of a million, because it's now being taught again in schools. So they practically wiped out the language. They destroyed all of the Welsh language. Nobody was allowed to write anything. And, well, so far so good. So we've stamped out the Welsh culture. Except this guy, and his name escapes me for the moment, it'll come to me in a minute. They call themselves the Forbidden Archaeologists.
Cremo?
No. He's, they're on, Richard D. Hall's channel. If you go to Richard D. Hall's, richplanet.net, you'll find a whole load of stuff by the guys called the Forbidden Archaeologists or whatever. and they are really great guys. And they've been absolutely vilified for making stuff up and everything else. And I find their books absolutely amazing. I've got an awful lot of stuff that I've talked tonight out of their stuff, and it's just gone for the minute. But anyway, if you take, he said that if you take the Welsh writing, which is like scratches on rock, it's not Ogham, but it's somewhat similar to Ogham, marks on a rock, and they've made a cross reference for everybody who's not an expert on languages, which will translate that into Western characters, i.e. A, B, C, D, E. Yeah? And if you go to an Etruscan museum, whether you've got Etruscan stuff, and you look up what these characters mean, and you translate them to the Western script, you can look an awful lot of them up in a Welsh dictionary, which you can buy from your local travel shop. And I thought, yeah. So I tried it, and you can. So we have basically a Welsh language in the Etruscans in Italy. And those same people came to Wales. Meanwhile, and then they get on and they build Stonehenge and they do all sorts of interesting things. And then if you've been watching all the Stonehenge stuff, it's all been turned over in the last year or two. They've just finished a huge 12-year dig. And what they found was that some people came in, called the Beaker people, and when they turned up, they had higher quality art and different god system, and they basically abandoned Stonehenge and went on and did other stuff. Now, these Beaker people came from Switzerland. So it's the other lot have now joined them, having come another route across Europe, taking 1,000 years or so to do it. And of course the other, a lot of the other Jewish tribes ended up in Denmark, the tribe of Dan, and so on and so on and so on, which is why you get the Sumerian gods, which were all known to the people of Qumran, of Qumri, because they all had the same Sumerian gods and the Anunnaki and all that lot and all their stories. And now they're now in Scandinavia. And you just change the name to local names and all the old Anunnaki tales are sat there, but being done by people like Woden and Freya and those people. And it's all joined up. And I think I've now lost the plot because we're now a long way from where we were, but it's interesting how all of these things are joined up.
Well, you know, back in our time, all of these things need to be known because they're all parts of the big puzzle.
Yeah.
As we were talking about before, you know, everybody's got a piece of the puzzle. Now, here you filled in a very nice history of how what we call Christianity actually became merged into the Roman Empire. Still, there was a kind of nugget of control in there. The control module had separated from the Roman Empire and had now attached it to the back end of the church and was ruling it in secret and using it and collecting taxes in the guise of tithing.
Yep.
So
nothing new under the sun.
New under the sun, is there? And there we go. And that's a proverb as well, isn't it? That's in the first edition in the Old Testament.
So what you have is you've got the Old Testament people being dragged out of the Holy Land with their tales and stuff. They end up in basically the very north of Mesopotamia. They get all the Assyrian god, the gods from there, all the Anunnaki stories and all the rest of it, because stories of Woden and Thor and all that, they're all the Anunnaki stories if you just want to change the names, you know. And then they truck that right across Europe, and then you end up with Jesus ending up in or at least, well, probably Jesus and maybe Mary and Joseph of Arimathea, and we haven't even talked about Philip the Apostle, another one. He turns up probably as well. Somebody said he turned up because one of his missions was he was sent to Gaul, i.e. France, and Spain, and one of the bishops referred to what a cracking job Philip had done when he came to Britain doing a an evangelical mission. Now that's rather interesting. So we've got two apostles in Britain doing evangelizing before Peter's off the starting block.
Perhaps Peter's just really slow off the starting block. He's a slow learner.
He was busy being in prison, wasn't he? He got locked up for quite a long time. So, meanwhile, these guys are all doing that.
So, plenty of time to think and plot.
Yeah. So you've got all those things going on. So, meanwhile, there are other things going on. I mean, you've got a group of you've got an offshoot of this lot, I think. I'm not exactly sure where they came from because I've been trying to track it down, and I find there were too many stories of where they came from. They can't have been from all these places. It's nonsense. You know what I mean? There are too many legends. They can't have come from all these different places. They come from somewhere. I reckon they came from the Wells Glastonbury Centre, which is, you know, where the whole thing kicked off. And they end up up north in the Scottish islands off, you know, these are remote, very beautiful, jagged islands for people who don't know where it is. I mean, they remind me of the islands off California, but do that mad snow and you're somewhere near it, and the sea's pretty choppy, and they all went there to be peace, solitude, meditation, getting close to nature, all the rest of it. And they're up there and they send a bunch of people. I'm missing something big out, but I'll carry on with this bit. They sent a bunch of people into England and started proselytizing, and they created churches left, right and centre. And in AD 576, Augustine sends across a bunch of people to Christianize the English, and found a thriving church, and he was not best pleased. But there's a big bit of the thing I missed out. So can you wind us back, please, 30 years? Excellent. Right.
Right, so 30 years ago.
In 562 AD. And I've done a lot of work on this. If I was ever going to write a book, it would be the story of this. But as I've told everybody, there wouldn't be much point. Once upon a time, in 562 AD, a bright light appears over Norway. It's really bright. It's casting shadows. It's like daylight. And this thing streaks across the sky in a southeasterly direction, lighting up southern Norway. The kids in Norway are told about this in school. People in Britain are not told this story. And yet I can back it up with 32 solid references. And this light appeared in the sky, and it was bright, and it was silent. and it streaked away in the direction of Britain. And they knew exactly where Britain was. There was a lot of trade between the Norwegians and the British. They called it raping and pillaging, and we called them bastards. But nevertheless, there was trade, and even intermarriage. And they knew exactly where Britain was, and they said this thing went in the direction of Britain, 562, right in the middle of the Viking invasions. It streaks across. It's getting lower. The next reference I get to it is Edinburgh. And it is very bright. It lit the place up like daytime. It carries on down Britain until you get to Carlisle. Now, for people in America, people in England think that England is two-thirds of Britain in length, and it isn't. It's about half the length. If you get a map of Britain and divide it in half, pretty much everything in the top half is Scotland. And where that ruler goes through the country is a place called Carlisle. Above Carlisle, this bright light split into three separate large pieces. One carries on, one spins off to the left, one spins off to the right. The bit that went to the left, and when it split, it made a peculiar shape in the sky, and they called it the Dragon Comet. And it split into this thing split, and it goes down the length of England, slightly to the left of the Pennines. That's slightly to the left of centre for people who don't know the geography. And it goes right over the Pennines. Now, the Pennines are low mountains, and it scorched the top of the mountains. It set, and I quote, it set England on fire from end to end. That is a eyewitness quote.
Just like the dragon in The Hobbit I just watched.
I wonder where they get this stuff from.
So,
it sets Britain on fire from end to end. The crops are all set on fire. It goes right across the lot of a lot of old Roman towns. Now, for our people who don't understand the chronology, the Romans were in Britain until about 440, and most of the army then disappeared to stop the marauding barbarians, as they called them, or Celts, if you want to call them that, who were giving them a bit of stick and eventually ran them over. So the army had all gone. They had taken most of their wives with them. They'd taken most of their wives with them. But nevertheless, the cities were still there. The roads were still there. The baths with houses were still there. The temples were still there. And if you've got a city, cities like that, you would keep using them, wouldn't you? I would, you know, just because the Romans are gone, I'd go, that's a bit of luck. I'm going to have Freddy the Shoemaker's shop because he's not going to need it anymore. And I'd take it over and I'd mend the roof. Wouldn't you? I would. Now, when we dig them up, we find this isn't the case. What we find is rubble, and they built a new town next to it. Not on top of it. Well, they did in some places. The further east you get in Britain, the more they built on top. But the further west you go, the more they built one on the side. And the Anglo-Saxons, who by now had taken the place over, said they wouldn't build on top of the Roman things because it was full of ghosts. Now, if we're in England, and there was a war, and most people went off to fight, I don't know, the Germans, the Russians, the Chinese, who cares, and didn't come back. You can bet your bottom dollar that 120 years later, those cities would still be working, the roads might not be in good condition, but they'd still be working, they'd fix the roof houses, they'd fix the roofs up on most of them. It's a valuable resource, you wouldn't start pulling them down and putting up grass houses next to it. I don't believe it. But that's what happened. So why? Well, this comet went streaking all the way down, and I reckon that it basically wiped out those towns, knocked half of them down, killed the people, and this is the important bit, it poisoned the groundwater. And when you go up onto those high Pennines, where it was closest to the comet, and you examine the water, not the water itself, because that's clean now, but if you look in the bottom of the gravel bits of the bottoms of waterfalls and that kind of thing, you find far more heavy elements than there should be. Things like selenium, lead, nickel. And so it set the whole place from end to end. The death toll was quoted by two different people as being around 2 million. I don't reckon there were 2 million people there at that time, but it was a huge number. What was left of the British Army, except there wasn't really a Britain as such, but what remnants of the army were all told to bugger off and get out of the way so that they could rebuild, and they went to France. And some 5,000 troops turn up in France on boats in pretty bad condition, and they're not very well. They're showing signs of poisoning, they're showing hair falling out, they've got spots, they're not in very good condition. And they said to the Franks or whoever was running France at the time, we need help. Can you ask the Pope to send us help? There are, quote, 2 million dead or dying over there. So they sent, the French duly sent off a guy, presumably on a horse, to the Pope, asking for papal aid, and they were all hoping that hundreds of ships would arrive from all over the Christian world to bail them out. Mercy mission. However, the Pope, when he saw it, said, what? Rocks falling from heaven. There are no rocks in heaven. This is heresy. And he took the messages, which apparently there were a lot of them, and he bound them up, and he ordered them to be destroyed, which it would seem they were. However, the letter, the order that the Pope wrote to destroy the papers and all the evidence exists. So we know that happened, and basically he let everybody die of poisoning. Now if we look in the Arthurian legend and other legends of the time, there are stories of the Badlands. Now the Badlands in King Arthur's time, you went in there, your horse died, you didn't come out. If you went in, you better not eat or drink anything, and you better get out as soon as you can. Badlands, water, selenium, lead, poisoned water. Give it another 20 years, most of that's all been flushed to the sea. The place is recovering. The Vikings arrive en masse. they find practically an empty country. They take the place over. The Pope thinks, this is a bit handy, Harry. And he sends St. Augustine. St. Augustine turns up. Let me get it right. 23 years after the comet. Only to find those guys I just told you about had come down from Scotland and were proselytising everybody. So, basically, the Anglo-Saxons and the Vikings basically found an open goal, and they just basically were able to take the place over. And what happened to the other two bits of the comet, I might tell you another time. So, how's that then, Jay?
So,
and why didn't the Pope help? Because they were the wrong sort of Christians.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I've also heard, I live in Scotland, right?
By the way, I definitely know where one of the other bits ended up.
Okay. Now, I live in Scotland, and up in the north here, there is a legend in the northwest coast of Scotland that Jesus went to a school in the Summer Isles, which is strangely reflective of the Somerset people, you know. So there may be a thing about mystery schools and summer islands and things like that, and summer schools and all of that. There's a kind of thing there. There's
well,
a meme
well, the,
there. Yeah.
The Druids were highly organised. I mean, all we ever see about Druids is, you know, people in white cloaks with funny glasses and a gold sickle whose name is Cyril. I remember having a run-in with a Druid once in Stonehenge who got in my way by mistake, and somebody said, "Run, Cyril!" And he picked up his skirts and ran as the whole crowd burst through the, you know, the wire that was holding everybody back. And but that to me burst the bubble. I mean, a druid called Cyril, I just can't take Cyril.
I know, it breaks it.
That's broke the spell.
There's a bloke he's even changed his name to Arthur Pendragon, right?
Well, he's not King of Kings, so somebody should chop him down.
I know, but nobody has. Nobody's.
Oh, well.
And he smokes Marlboro. You know, I just like remember that we were up at the Holy Thorn when I lived in Glastonbury in the 90s. I was up there when the Holy Thorn was still, you know, sprinkling out. We did a ceremony around there, and there he was, and we did the thing, and everybody went home and everything. As you do in Glastonbury, you know, on a regular basis, whenever there's a moon or a half moon or a Tuesday or, it's 4 o'clock, you know, any excuse to go and gather around the Holy Thorn and sing things. So,
you mean any excuse for a piss up?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, basically, yeah, we're, you know, that's
now we're on the same page.
Now we're talking. Yeah. So, and there is this lovely festival thing about the whole the idea of a magical kingdom. You know, that there is a the mystery schools and the esoteric side and the understandings that were taught that were a little above, you know, and I described in the chat room earlier, which, by the way, hi everybody, it's brilliant, you're really alive, it's really excellent tonight, so thank you all for coming and participating.
I haven't looked, is there anybody saying anything?
Oh yeah, so I mean, they all talk about all sorts of stuff. I mean, people, but there's loads of people in there and some are listening. It's great.
I meant any pertinent
questions. Any pertinent questions, let's have a look. Let me just go back there.
I could literally carry on forever.
Well, we got 20 minutes.
I know, we haven't got forever, yeah. I mean, I'm not short of material, but if there's anybody wants to ask anything, I'm
right, well,
I'm game for that.
Here's one. This is one from Time Is Now. Is that the same Peter who chided Jesus for making Mary head of the disciples? And the 562 AD comet is in some of the paintings of that time, she said.
Yeah, it would be.
Yes.
No, it's a physical event. It absolutely happened. The Roman Catholic Church, well, the Pope, who's, I should know which Pope it was, but I've forgotten for the minute, he ordered that all, and I mean all references to this, were heresy, because stones don't fall from heaven, there aren't any stones in heaven, right, be stricken from all the records. So everything in all the monasteries was, you know, all the people who would have turned up, you know, with their begging bowls, you know, starving to death, people getting across to Holland and things, that would have gone. But there are 32 distinct references to this in English, most of which are actually in France, from where the people turned up in France, but some in remote areas of Britain, who weren't Roman Catholics. You see what I mean? So some of this does exist. Now, if you look in your history books, English people, but American people too, because I know, I'm going to be getting in trouble now. I mean, I lived in America, and from what I can see, American history started in 1492, and nothing much happened before then, which I'm a bit aghast at. But before that, they have English history, and you've got what they call the Dark Ages. And the Dark Ages basically start when the Romans disappeared, and start again just before the Roman conquest, when Bede wrote his stuff in 800 and something, and there's not much after that, and until the Normans turn up and start writing everything down. So why do we have this Dark Age? Why is it we haven't got that history? And the answer is really simple. They were all dead. History stopped. The Vikings came in. Whatever they wrote wasn't in English. They weren't writing it on parchments. They weren't storing it away. That's why you've got the Dark Ages. And if you want to know what went on in England in that period, really, it's going to sound really stupid, you don't even look in Norway, you look in Iceland, because the Norwegian Vikings who came down and came in and sorted all the problems out, gave us a lot of stick, they weren't all bad, but they were pretty bad news if you were a Brit on the coast. Those guys got invaded by Sweden, and Norway basically got wiped out, and Sweden took the place over, and anybody that could get in a boat took the records and some grub and a few goats and whatever they could lay their hands on, and they disappeared to Iceland to get out of the way. Later, there was a resistance comeback coup, and they managed to get quite a lot of Norway back, but nowhere near as much as they used to have, and they brought a lot of the records back. But if you want to look at what the hell was happening in England between, you know, kind of 500 AD and 1000 AD, there's a wealth of stuff in Iceland. Anyway, I just mentioned that in passing.
Right. Well, let's just now they're really cooking in there. We got 20 minutes left, so we have to speak really fast. What does the speaker? Yeah, she's and time is now. She's really into it. What does the speaker think about Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland, in just south of Edinburgh?
I don't think that's relevant to any of this. It's far later.
Okay, and
I mean, I could give my thoughts on that, but I think that's a totally different subject, Joe.
All right. And did the Catholic Church add 325 years to the calendar?
I don't think so.
No. So, what are you talking about in terms of...
I know there was a big argument about... there was a big argument about Easter. One of the problems that the English church had Easter on a different date. And there was a hell of a stink about that. And poor old St. Cuthbert, who was from the Orkney, Scottish Island bit, who was coming over and converting people and doing a pretty good job, but he was not from the Roman Catholic tradition, he was from the other one. He came in for a lot of stick about Easter, because when St. Augustine and his mates turned up and set up base and found these Christians already there, and they said, but we're from the Pope, and they said, who's the Pope and we don't care, basically. And St. Cuthbert was given the job of smoothing it all over, and all the rest of the monks legged it back to this Scottish island. But there was a big fuss, and the big sticking point about, it's a bit like trying to join back together Church of England with it is exactly the same as joining back the Church of England with the Church of Rome, in that certain strongly held beliefs on both sides aren't movable. And one of them was when Easter was. Anyway, St. Cuthbert.
I have a thing about Easter.
Guy.
Good old St. Cuthbert. Easter is simply the first full moon after the spring equinox.
Unless you're a British Christian when it isn't.
Because they're stupid. You're a British...
I think it's all to do with the calendar changes. The Julian calendar changes.
Because I live near a place that celebrates a new year on the 10th of January. Did you know that? It's the Viking New Year. The Julian New Year.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't surprise me. So you can imagine Easter would be wrong. So... they won't have any... Yes, well, there you go. What you're looking at there is the legacy of the... I'm going to change the word now. British Catholic Church. You with me? You've got a different Easter.
We have all sorts of weird holidays in this town as well. For no apparent reason.
Well, I think there are. If you go back to what I'm saying about the English Church... and when their festivals were, and they had a big outpost where you were, I think you might find it line up.
I find it very interesting that I happen to be...
Somebody needs to do that, and you're on the spot, mate.
Yeah, it's really interesting that I happen to have lived in Glastonbury, I've lived in London, I've lived in Glastonbury, and I've lived up here. All which seem to be, centres of something.
Well, everywhere's the centre of somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, wherever I am. You know, I have this thing, whenever I'm at a party, right? Whenever I'm at a party, no matter where I am, in any house, whatever room it is, whatever part of any room, it becomes a corridor, and people start walking past me. It's just a strange thing, and it always happens.
What, real people?
Everybody. It's like... I might be in a space, right? It's very quiet. Nobody's there. So I'm going out, have a chat, have a pipe. And nobody there. And you start having a good chat. And then people start walking past. Then other people stand with you, doing their thing. And eventually it's no longer a kind of quiet place anymore. And people are walking past you, pushing past you. And this seems to happen continually through my party experience, no matter where I stand. But anyway, I don't know what that is.
Right. Well, we have 10 minutes. Do you want me to plough on, wrap up?
I want you to
leave you on a bombshell. What do you want?
Plug yourself. You do have a radio station.
Plug myself.
You do talk to guests. You talk to people about stuff. What kind of stuff do you talk about? How do people find you? And you don't have a show on Sunday, presumably.
I don't have a show at all.
You don't have a show at all? All right.
Oh, no. No, no. Well, where do I start? Well, I run, or rather, I am, I'll start with who I'm married to, because that's important. I am married to Sally Tutor, who is on Facebook as Sally Godwin Tutor, which is her previous name in honour of the kids. Yeah, so she's Sally Godwin Tutor, I'm John Tutor. And we run a thing called Deprogrammed Radio, which is not a radio... It's more like Wolf Spirit than your program, in that we provide a platform for others, where we talk about stuff like this. We have people like Micah Hanks on there. We have people like Soraya Razkath, Where Did the Road Go? We have Alternative Health. Basically, if the main channel won't have you on, and it's ethical, and it's of reasonable quality, we'll give you a platform. That's one thing we do. Two, my missus, Sally, is an archaeologist, author, published poet, and she edits books for people. So if you've got a book in the mix, that's what she does. She'll tidy it up and knock it into shape and do that. And my other job is I make websites, but I'm afraid I haven't got a book to sell, which makes me a total fraud on an alternative radio show.
Well, no,
because it's the law.
No, it's not.
Yes,
not,
it's
not round here.
Not round here. Oh, right.
No. Right. So if you've got, you know, because I haven't got a book yet. So if you're in process, everybody's in process, and I recognize people, you know, people kind of stand out and I think, oh yeah, yeah, I should talk to that person, and they've got something to share, they've got a piece of the puzzle, everybody's got the piece of the puzzle, you know,
because we're all of us looking for the corner.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Only four of us can. In the end, there can only be four. What?
Right, right. I'm gonna finish it up with something
Go
that
ahead.
I think a lot of rubbish is talked about. Okay, which is the First Council of Nicaea. You've heard of that?
Yeah, that sounds like a real party.
I'll tell you what, it weren't boring. Now, what happened was, because Constantine, getting back to Constantine, he had a problem. He was trying to have one religion, one church, one emperor. Yeah, because his mum said so, and she'd got a lot of work under her belt to get to this situation. And so, to get one church, they had to get them all in one smoke-filled room. Assuming the Phoenicians had brought the tobacco from the New World that week. And they had to get in there and come out with one answer. Yeah? So they shoved them all in a room and they said, right, go on there, get in there. And the Gnostics weren't playing. The Arians weren't playing. Well, they were playing a bit and all the rest of it. And finally, they cobbled something together, which was to become the Nicene Creed. But the Gnostics weren't playing. So he said, well, that's not good enough. Go back in there and start again. So they all go back in there, and they came out with the same answer. Well, that's pretty interesting. Not. So, they did the honourable thing. Most of the Gnostics were in Alexandria, Abyssinia, that sort of area. So, Caesar sent a legion and had them wiped out. I mean, it's the only honourable thing to do, wasn't it, really? So, he gets rid of those. But there's a lot of things that people think they did there that they didn't. First of all, he did not make Christianity the only and state religion of Rome. You see it all over the web, and he didn't. He just allowed it, and it was his preferred one, but he didn't ban anything else. What else didn't happen? The idea of the Trinity was not decided. They did not decide which books to throw out of the Bible. And you see that all over the place, especially on fundamentalist sites. They did not decide to do that, and nothing much was decided there. It was all decided about 150 years later. So all this stuff about a Nicaea, they all got into a room, chucked out all the rubbish, and created the Roman Catholic Church is not true. It actually happened about 150 years later. So I'll leave you with that. But there's so much misinformation about that out there, and it is just not true. Right.
So, your radio station once again.
Deprogrammed, one word. Right, sorry, deprogrammed radio, one word. .com.
Deprogrammed radio. You are listening to Deprogrammed Radio. Thank you very much, John. It's been a real pleasure. I hope to have you again one day. We can chew the fat. It's been a very interesting trip.
Well, another day you can ask me where the other two bits of the comment went. There's a program in that.
Well, that sounds very interesting. All right, mate.
Okay.
It's been Cockney night. It's been like...
In it.
Good night, everybody.
Leave it out, John.
All right. Two expat Cockneys. All right. We're away from here. Good night. This has been Ever Beyond. Okay.